literally going off stage and down the hill, and their music separates out. So as the chorus goes off stage, they are intercut with the orchestra. So the orchestra plays this extraordinary sort of music, and that suddenly is torn off. And the chorus sings a little bit of what they've just been singing a couple of minutes ago, and then that is torn off, and the orchestra comes back again. And the final three pages, there are three statements of this orchestral passage, and they literally stop, and there is absolute silence. And then it rotates again, and there's absolute silence. And the third time round, it actually does come finally to the last chord. But this is a most extraordinary passage and idea. I can't think of anything else quite like it anywhere, actually. It's a most extraordinary bit of invention.
I'm also interested to know, Oliver, why Tippett chose to write his own librettos.
Well, there had been lots of mooted attempts with specific librettists. Tippett wrote a couple of early operas with the poet Christopher Fry, which he then said were not going to be part of his official list of compositions. Then there was a mooted opera with W.H. Auden, which came to nothing. Then he asked T.S. Eliot to write a libretto to the oratorio we've already mentioned, A Child of Our Time. Eliot refused and said, I don't see how any opera composer, or indeed oratorio composer, can do anything other than write his own texts. Partly because Eliot and, I think, Tippett believed that any beautiful qualities in poetry, what we might call verbal music, you know, sort of acoustic qualities in good poetry, would be completely shot into the air by the music of music, as it were. And
I don't think Eliot quite realised what he might be letting us in for with
this
advice.
We should say that Tippett wrote librettos to all five of his operas right until he died, and many other things besides. Also, Tippett just had complete control. He very much didn't like Arthur Bliss's opera, The Olympians, which Covent Garden had premiered a few years before, also rather oddly set at midsummer. I don't know why everybody clustered around this solstice. But he said that Bliss refused to pay any attention really to the libretto, and the structure was all over the place. And I think it's quite Wagnerian. Wagner, of course, uses the word Gesamtkunstwerk, the total artwork. And I think Tippett, through writing his own text, is able to create works that are unique in that he has utter creative control. The text is not to be read as literature, it is to be harnessed by the music. And it allows him very, very, very precisely, I would say, to say what he has to say. If the libretto is confusing, you just listen to the music. Because if the libretto is, and some say it is, a mishmash of cymbals and hodgepodges, there is this sort of magic net of the music which does pull it all together and explains, to my ears anyway, what's going on.
I think that's absolutely true. It still, I think, to some extent, is subject to this opinion that the Midsummer Marriage, i.e. that there's such a confusion, or supposedly such a confusion in the text, that this still seems, and I find this hard to understand, this still seems to be a barrier to people's appreciation of this piece. I found the first time I heard the whole piece, as opposed to just the ritual dances, it was an utter revelation in my life. The sound of this music was quite extraordinary. The sheer luminosity and the energy is absolutely remarkable, I think. And whatever else may or may not be confusing in it, at the end of the day, it stands to my ears on the sound of the music, the sound it makes, as Beecham would have said, you know, it's the noise it makes, you know. Yes. And that is its ultimately its justification, I think.
And Michael was somebody who was absolutely wonderful at keeping to his own vision of what he wanted to do. He wouldn't have worried in a funny way. He'd have laughed, actually. I mean, of course, we all want to be loved, and I'm sure, you know, he'd more like everyone else. But he was somebody who had quite an intense vision of what an artist should be. I remember talking to him about that period of music and saying, did it worry you at all that British music appeared to be sort of 50 years behind the continent? And he actually got quite angry and said, not at all. He thought that what British composers were doing at that time, Walton, Britten, my father, was very important, had their own voice, and they shouldn't be aping the continent. And that, in fact, the fact that they did not was a quality. Well, we could all debate that in many ways, but were talking about him, and that was his view. I mean, he felt very strongly, and then we haven't talked about his, you know, looking back to people, the Madrigal composers, the people he conducted at Morley College, you know, Purcell and things like that. He had a very strong feeling about who he was as a British composer, and he was very proud of it.
What images do you think we will take home with us tonight?
Although the orchestra is not particularly large, I think it's a big piece and it needs space because it spreads a lot. It spreads out a lot in time. It's like Wagner, you know, hier wird die Zeit das Raum in Parsifal, here time becomes space. And I think therefore, because this piece stretches out in time, it's got there's a bigness about it, which I think is well suited to a large performing space, actually.
There is such a...
It's generous, isn't it?
Oh, it's generous, and it's also sort of vertical, in that, as you will hear, if not see, in the first act, Jennifer ascends a spiral staircase into heaven and Mark goes down into the earth, into Hades. And the sort of vertical cavernousness of the Albert Hall will be, you know, very useful for imagining staircases going up into the beyond.
And, of course, historically, this is very important because, you know, Britain had got opera going in this country with Grimes. And the fact that we had another composer producing works of the quality of Midsummer Marriage and King Priam meant that, you know, that he wasn't acting alone, Britain, that we actually had different ways of looking at opera.
Yes.
And that was very important in the history of British music.
And we can all enjoy it tonight. Michael Barclay, Oliver Soden, Paul Webster, thank you very much.
That was an edited version of the Proms Plus event held earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. It was introduced by Louise Fryer and produced by Helen Garrison. And don't forget that there is a Proms Plus feature associated with every prom in the season. You'll find details of them all in the Proms Guide and also on the BBC Proms website. You're listening to the BBC Proms here on Radio 3 with Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall for this concert performance of Sir Michael Tippett's 1955 opera, The Midsummer Marriage, conducted by Sir Andrew Davis, as we celebrate Tippett's music at the 2013 Proms, 15 years after his death. It would have been lovely to be able to talk to the composer about the opera. Last time I saw Tippett was at the Glyndebourne production of his sci-fi epic New Year back in 1990, but we have found a clip of Tippett talking to Roy Plumley on Desert Island Discs, telling him how The Midsummer Marriage came into being.
I had written operas before, quite a number of them, of various kinds, and they sound rather grand, but I have been constantly in the theatre. And so I came to feel that I knew what the opera that I wanted to write should be, and that it should be an opera which should have two great things behind it. One was Mozart, which was The Magic Flute, which therefore was an opera about illumination, and getting there, you see, at the point at which the vision appears. And the other was The Midsummer Night's Dream of Shakespeare, because Shakespeare was the absolute, always has been, I mean, the theatre. It's a wonderful world of tremendous variety. Out of these came this belief that I could put somewhere upon the stage this going from this world of the everyday into the theatre of magic.
Didn't he just, as we're finding out this evening at the Proms. Sir Michael Tippett talking to Roy Plumley on BBC Radio 4's Desert Island Discs back in 1985. And that's an edition you can hear in full online from the Desert Island Discs archive on the Radio 4 website. Well, for this Proms performance of The Midsummer Marriage, we don't have any staging or opera house production to distract us from Tippett's ravishing music. Kenneth Richardson's stage direction here is a model of economy and simplicity. So, at the end of Act 1, the marriage is on hold while the bride and groom set off in opposite directions on their journeys of self-discovery and spiritual enlightenment. Mark and Jennifer are the Tamino and Pamina figures Tippett borrowed from Mozart's Magic Flute. The other couple are in much better shape, as we're about to find out. Papageno and Papagena reincarnated as Jack and Bella. As the chorus wanders the woods, singing under the bright midsummer sun, Bella asks Jack to hang behind. She proposes to him, and they dream together of settling down, renting a little house, looking forward to the arrival of a little Jack or Bella, and singing a lullaby to the baby. As they walk dreamily into the wood together, Tippett's ritual dances begin. First, the earth in autumn, for which, in Tippett's detailed stage directions, we see two dancers as a hound hunting a hare which escapes behind the temple. More dancers are disguised as the roots of great trees, and they come to life to set out the course of a river in the second ritual dance, the waters in winter. This time, it's a fish being chased by an otter and getting stuck amongst the water nymphs as it tries to escape. The river disappears and the dancers sow a field of spring corn for the third ritual dance, the air in spring. A bird with a broken wing is pecking in the cornfield under the shadow of a descending hawk. The exhausted bird seems unable to escape, to the horror of Bella, who's been watching the dance with Jack and seems to think that the hawk dancer really meant to kill the one portraying the bird. Jack calms her down, and she settles herself by taking a mirror from her handbag and applying her makeup. Face back on, she's ready to rejoin King Fisher, who, to Jack's alarm, apparently has another role for them to play. As he chases after her, in an echo of the ritual dances, the chorus returns and then dies away into stillness at the end of the second act. Well, Jack is sung by Alan Clayton and Bella by Eilish Tynan. Stephen Bryant's just finishing tuning the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And here to conduct the BBC Singers Symphony Orchestra and Chorus in the second act of Tippett's opera, The Midsummer Marriage, it's Sir Andrew Davis. It's the afternoon, and Bella has something she wants to say to Jack.
Thank you. something new in mind, but I can never guess.
Oh, this time is quite different. What day is it?
Midsummer day.
Isn't that excuse enough?
I've no idea. And
Thank you. For him or
does Kingfisher matter now?
Jack, dear, our love has spoken, our home is sure. I leave Kingfisher at the proper time. Today he's still my master, and worth a while to suffer.
Now I have strange misgivings, unfriendly fancies and forebodings.
Don't you see me now? It is fact, not fancy, and it's a fact that if you want to keep me, get me if you can, if you can.
Three ritual dances and the simple dreams of Jack and Bella for their future happiness. You've just heard the second act of The Midsummer Marriage by Sir Michael Tippett, with Bella sung by Eilish Tynan and Jack by Alan Clayton, with the BBC Singers, Symphony Chorus and Symphony Orchestra conducted by Sir Andrew Davis. Some of the singers offstage conducted by Stephen Jackson. Well, there's a fourth ritual dance to look forward to, Fire in Summer, which is at the climax of the opera's third act, as we catch up with the fate of the opera's other more complicated couple who are still undergoing their search for self-discovery and spiritual enlightenment in Tippett's versions of heaven and hell, the light and dark sides of the human psyche that have to be reconciled. Sir Andrew Davis back on stage. All the singers and players on their feet for the applause of the promenaders here in the Royal Albert Hall. Well, the third act is still 20 minutes away. This evening's second interval here on BBC Radio 3 gives us a chance to catch up on some real summer rituals from around the UK. Steve Rowd, author of The English Year and a leading authority on folklore, songs and playground games, surveys the customs and rituals of midsummer in What Visions Have I Seen?
It sounds an excellent idea to explore the traditions of midsummer, but nothing in folklore is as easy as it sounds, and what we want or expect is often at sharp odds with what is available. What we really want from our traditional customs is a neat progression throughout the year, with something special on each and every day, so we know where we stand. As the clown says in All's Well That Ends Well, a pancake for Shrove Tuesday, a Morris for May Day. But the history of our traditional calendar customs is messy. Instead of a straight orderly progression, customs bunch up at certain points in the year, leaving other times relatively barren. They move about, change, and mean very different things to different people. Midsummer is a case in point. We think it must have been a major festival in the folk calendar, and we conjure up vague ideas of druids and Stonehenge and other romantic fictions.
This is an original British festival, though, isn't it? 5,000 years old, people have been coming here.
But the actual documentary record for the day is remarkably thin compared to other times of year. Winter is much easier to deal with. From Halloween and Guy Fawkes to Plough Monday on the 6th of January, there's plenty of interesting customs. Soul cakers, cataners, mummers, sword dancers, wassailers, plough jags, and many more.
Christmas or Christmas not, I hope old Father Christmas will never be forgot. Christmas comes but once a year, then we generally get a very good cheer.
The Marshfield Paperboys from Marshfield in Gloucestershire with their Boxing Day custom.
In comes I, little man John. Anyone defy me, let them come on.
Most of these were visiting customs, in which the people in question went round the village doing their thing, acting a play, singing a song, reciting a rhyme, doing a dance, and collecting money, food or drink. And this is perhaps the key to the concentration of such customs in the winter months. That's when the rural poor needed help most, and when agricultural work was at its most unreliable. There's also plenty to say about spring and May Day. The people of Padstow in Cornwall who welcome the summer with their Obby Os every year. In late summer, we have harvest customs to keep us busy.
I have
a recording made in 1937, also in Cornwall, of a harvest custom which they still do there called crying the neck when they cut the last sheaf of corn. But back to Midsummer. Shakespeare hasn't helped, as he led us all astray with the title of A Midsummer Night's Dream, so that we all think that Midsummer was the traditional time for fairies and sprites to be particularly active, when one might, like Titania, see visions and be enamoured of an ass. It seems the height of impertinence to question Mr. Shakespeare, but there is precious little evidence from any independent source that this was the night for supernatural activity in England. But surely Shakespeare can't be wrong. He's not in fact guilty of inaccuracy or, heaven forbid, deliberately lying, but merely of confusing us. He doesn't actually say that the action of the play takes place at Midsummer at all. And indeed, in Act 4, Scene 1, he makes it clear that it all happened on the night of the 30th of April, the eve of May Day. When Theseus finds the young lovers asleep in the woods and wonders what brought them there, he comes to the conclusion, no doubt they rose up early to observe the rite of May. Now there is plenty of evidence for May Day Eve being a time for witches and fairies, in Britain as well as across the continent, and May Day morning was certainly the time for going out at dawn to gather greenery to decorate houses and to bathe your face in the May dew, because it is excellent for the complexion. Shakespeare's folkloric credentials are therefore intact, but why he called the play A Midsummer Night's Dream remains a mystery, although it is more catchy than An April the 30th's Night's Dream. Maybe folk song can help. They're always set in the summer.
As I rode out one midsummer's morning for to view take the air down by the banks of the sweet primroses.
Shirley Collins singing The Banks of Sweet Primroses. But again, things are not what they seem. Primroses in midsummer? just about as likely as gathering nuts in May. So what was there at Midsummer? One of the key features of the season was the popularity of bonfires. John Stowe, the famous chronicler of London life in the 1590s, stressed the good neighbourhood and amity inherent in the bonfire, and he wrote of people building them in the street on the eves of the summer saints' festivals.
Every man bestowing wood or labour towards them, the wealthier sort also, before their doors, near to the said bonfires, would set out tables furnished with sweetbread and good drink. They would invite their neighbours and passengers also to sit and be merry with them in great familiarity.
Specifically on the eves of St John the Baptist and St Peter and Paul, 29th of June, John Stowe adds,
"Every man's door being shadowed with green birch, long fennel, St John's wort, orpin, white lilies and such like, garnished upon with garlands of beautiful flowers, and also lamps of glass with oil burning in them all night. Some hung out branches of iron curiously wrought, containing hundreds of lamps alight at once, which made a goodly show."
Probably the last surviving example of the Midsummer bonfire is at Walton, near Morpeth in Northumberland, which still takes place on Old Midsummer's Eve, about the 5th of July, each year. And there have been several revivals of them in the West Country.
"My two aunt Hanses in Hanno Dill. Now set the pyre at once on fire. Let flame as fire in God's high name."
"His matches are foot long."
In addition to the neighbourly aspect that John Stowe mentions, there was sometimes a notion that the smoke from these fires was beneficial because it purified the air, which led to some in authority to condemn the fires as superstitious. But bonfires feature in a wide number of traditional customs, and the idea of air purification and disinfection was common to them all, while houses decorated with flowers and greenery are also better known at other times of the year. So Midsummer, again, is the poor relation. One custom specific to the day, however, was the making of Midsummer cushions, which was recorded in the 18th and 19th centuries in Northumberland, Durham, and by the Northamptonshire poet John Clare. The custom involved smearing damp clay on top of a stool or other suitable surface and decorating it by pressing flowers and greenery into it, like a small-scale fusion of a May Day garland with a well dressing. These cushions were displayed outside people's doors, sometimes simply to delight the neighbours, but sometimes to raise money from them. John Clare called one of his collections of poems the Midsummer Cushion, and the custom has been revived in Helpston, where he lived. A number of other customs which were not specific to Midsummer took place across the Midsummer months, such as well dressing.
"We started on the dressing on Monday, and it takes a full week of back-breaking work. We put clay in, and then we have to prick it all out, petal it all."
"Well, what kind of size are we talking about? What's the scale of it?"
6 foot by 7.
"Jackie, I believe you're the artist."
"I am, yeah."
"What is the design this year?"
"It's the Bull's Head, the local pub. The theme is our village for every year, so it's nice to have a, you know, something different in the village."
"Yeah. Continuing a tradition, really, aren't we? That's right. Yes. Gone in Derbyshire for many, many years. It's about giving thanks for the water, and these villages all depended on the wells for the water."
"There's a real skill in how you put the petals and the stones and the slate and so on onto the clay to make the picture. And also with the petals, you have to make quite sure they're going in the right direction, because when it's standing upright, the water's got to run down the petals. You can't have the water collecting in the flowers, because it'll spoil the picture during the week."
"There's an art to petaling."
"Do you consider yourself a petaling artist?" "OK, I'm standing in front of the well-dressing now. I can see now that there is a lot of craft involved in this. So this is all into clay, is it? These are all individually pressed into clay?"
"Yes.
Every single, every petal, everything is individually pressed in. So this is chamomile's, all the hydrangea petals and the chrysanthemum petals."
"We've got a bit of slate there. Yes. That's cheating, isn't it?"
"No, because it's natural. Everything has to be natural.
I'm with you.
Even glass in the lanterns is natural because it's made from sand."
"Right, OK.
And these are peppercorns, all peppercorns.
Oh, yeah.
These are leaves, just leaves. These are eggshells."
The women of Tinswell in Derbyshire dressing their well in June 2010. Another custom is rush bearing, a remnant of the days when the churches had earth floors strewn with layers of rushes, which had to be changed periodically. And in many places, the practical necessity evolved into a symbolic and celebratory custom, which continued long after the real need was passed. In many places, it was a relatively restrained affair, with women and children in special costume coming on a specific day with small quantities of rushes, or with rushes woven into symbolic shapes which were used to decorate the church. And this still continues in a few places in the Lake District, such as Grasmere, each July.
To mark this annual rush bearing, a traditional festival where the rushes were taken to the church, but a time to celebrate all that is good about our community's life. So we're going to sing the rush bearing hymn.
In other places, however, the custom was far more robust, with specially decorated cartloads of rushes brought to the church in grand procession with music, drums and Morris dancers. Ah yes, Morris dancing, one of the most widespread symbols of an English summer scene. And it is, in fact, one of our oldest surviving customs, dating back at least 500 years. There are 9 references to the dance in the second half of the 15th century, with the earliest being in 1448. And it is interesting to note that some of these refer to fine art representations of a Morris dancer, which demonstrates that the character was already sufficiently well known at the time for people to make figures of him. Most people think of the Morris as a Whitsun or May Day custom, but it was clearly popular throughout the summer months, and some authorities